All right, so we're digging back into the story of Abraham today, this series called to cross over, and today we're going to talk a lot about integrity, because this message, it comes on the heels of the birth of Isaac and the expelling of Ishmael and Hagar that we talked about last week, and today it's going to bring back to us a character that was in an earlier part of the narrative, and Abraham's going to sort of have a renewal of this relationship with someone that he has already met, and it's going to be an opportunity for Abraham to deepen this existing relationship, and that process of deepening that relationship is going to begin with a very important question that centers around the idea of living a life of integrity. So let's dig right in. Genesis chapter 21, starting in verse 22. I'll be reading from a slightly different translation than normal because I kind of like the way that this one maps out some of the language. But Genesis 21, verses 22 to 34, if you want to follow along. And the words will be on the screen behind me as well. About this time, Abimelech came with Phicol, his army commander, to visit Abraham. God is obviously with you, helping you in everything that you do, Abimelech said. Swear to me in God's name that you will never deceive me, my children, or any of my descendants. I've been loyal to you, so now swear that you will be loyal to me and to this country where you are living as a foreigner. And Abraham replied, yes, I swear it. Then Abraham complained to Abimelech about a well that Abimelech's servants had taken by force from Abraham's servants. This is the first I've heard about it, Abimelech answered. I have no idea who is responsible. You have never complained about this before. Abraham then gave some of his sheep, goats, and cattle to Abimelech, and they made a treaty. But Abraham also took 7 additional female lambs and set them off by themselves. And Abimelech asked, why have you set these 7 apart from the others? And Abraham replied, please accept these 7 lambs to show your agreement that I dug this well. Then he named the place Beersheba, which means well of oath, because that was where they had sworn the oath. And after making their covenant at Beersheba, Abimelech left with Phicol, the commander of his army, and they returned home to the land of the Philistines. Then Abram planted a tamarisk tree at Beersheba, and there he worshiped the Lord, the eternal God. And Abraham lived as a foreigner in Philistine country for a long time. So if you're with us a few weeks ago, you know that the person who is making a reappearance is Abimelech. He was with us in this last chapter and the story before Isaac was born, and now he makes a reappearance. If you remember the story last time, basically Abraham and Sarah and all their people and all their herds and all their flocks came to the land, the territory of Abimelech, and Abimelech took Sarah into his household because Abraham played the old Egypt trick and said, no, she's my sister. And of course, if you remember, God spoke to Abimelech in a dream and then instructed Abimelech, you need to take this woman back to her rightful husband. And Abimelech obediently followed what God had told him to do. And he responded to Abraham's deception with generosity and grace upon grace, right? So now it's Abraham's opportunity to respond when Abimelech approaches him about a relationship. And it's important to note that Abimelech comes, the way that he comes in bringing this military commander, he recognizes Abraham as sort of a fellow local king. This is not just your average person who's kind of renting some of the soil. This is somebody who Abimelech respects, somebody who he recognizes as a leader, just as he is. And he says to Abraham, I can see, it's obvious to me that God is with you and that God is helping you. Now, the question we have to ask ourselves is, what in the world does Abimelech know about this God, and how does he see that God is helping and present with Abraham, right? Now, this is a God whom Abimelech has some experience with, right? Remember, he had this dream, and Abraham's God came to Abimelech in that dream and spoke to him, and Abimelech listened and responded in obedience with what he'd heard. So it's a God that he has some experience with. So I would say at the very least, he's remained sort of a curious onlooker into the life of Abraham since the time that he had that dream. I mean, if this God whom you've never heard of spoke to you in a dream, and there was somebody you knew who was connected to this God, you'd want to keep your eyes on that person, to maybe develop a better understanding of who this God is, what he does, and how he chooses to operate. I mean, obviously, Abimelech had the firsthand experience of the dream, but I would say beyond that, probably Abimelech heard the stories that got told and retold about how Abraham led a successful campaign to rescue his nephew Lot. I'm sure those stories spread among the people in the area. Another instance of God being with him, right? And now he shows up to visit Abraham and Sarah, and what does he find? A baby, a child, right? And remember, this is a couple we learned last week who were as good as dead. And so when you show up and a couple who were as good as dead now have this small child that they're cradling in their arms, you realize that this God must be with them. And who knows how much time has really passed, but if God's promises are good and true, Abraham has continued to prosper and to grow. And so there are many signs pointing to Abimelech looking at the life of Abraham and saying, "It is clear to me that God is present with you and is helping you." And so he then follows it up with this question. Will you, Abraham, treat me with integrity and not deception? Will you promise to treat me with integrity and not deception and promise that your descendants will do the same thing with my descendants? And deception is the perfect word for the episode with Sarah, right? The old half-truth. Oh, no, yeah, she's my sister. Well, she's kind of my sister, right? So Abimelech is now saying, listen, I know that this God who spoke to me is with you, and I want to know, will you live before me with a life of integrity and not with a life of deception and half-truth? And it leads me to this question. Will we as Christians who celebrate and proclaim God's presence with us today live as people of integrity in the view of curious onlookers? Will we have and live lives of integrity or not? Because we are still surrounded by curious onlookers. I mean, Abimelech had some experience with this God, but to think that he had a complete or even an accurate picture is probably a little bit too positive thinking, right? But as he watches Abraham's life, he sees, I think, more and more of the portrait of God becoming revealed if Abraham chooses to live with integrity. Abraham is this foreigner. This God, up until this point, is sort of this foreign God that Abimelech is trying to get to know, and through Abraham's life of integrity, it's possible. And don't forget that, like Abraham, we are still foreigners today, in a sense, right? Because we proclaim that Jesus Christ is our Lord, our Savior, and our King. We are people in his kingdom, and therefore in this world we are foreigners no matter where we go, because we are surrounded by people who in general are either ignorant of the God we worship or have very inaccurate or incomplete ideas of who he might be. So we are still foreigners, and there are still people looking at our lives, and hopefully they know that we are people who claim to be with God and be helped by God, just as Abraham was with God and helped by God. And the more we live lives of integrity, I believe we reveal to them the portrait of who this God is, of what this God is like. So it comes to this question, will we be people who live lives of integrity or not? And that word integrity is funny, depending on how you choose to use it or choose to understand it. One of the standard definitions I've been used to, and maybe you've heard this before, it goes something like this. Integrity is what you do when no one else is looking, right? Probably you guys have heard something similar. And that's true to a point. I agree with it. But especially when we look at this story today, integrity is all about what you do in relationship to other people, right? So I would put it maybe this way. Integrity is living with a wholeness of character even when it's inconvenient. Integrity is living with a wholeness of character even when it's inconvenient. I love that word wholeness. I was reading, studying this week, and somebody said, think of it this way, like whole numbers, whole integers. There are no fractions. Are there fractions in your life, in my life, where we say, well, I'm mostly this, but in some situations I'm this third and that half and this eighth over here? Do we have wholeness of life? Or maybe an even better way to understand it, and I know visuals help for some of us, a structure or a bridge needs to maintain structural integrity in order to be safe and useful, right? Structural integrity. Go ahead and throw that picture up there, Zach. Structural integrity. Anybody ever walked across a bridge like this before? One of those rope bridges that's essentially wooden planks with rope. Now, these people are lunatics because you can see how high that thing is. And there's not even like mesh rope along there. There's just a couple handles to hold on to and that's all you've got, right? But even if you try and walk across one of those things, if it's just 20 or 30 feet above water, you still kind of go, whoa, and you can feel it sway in the wind. I've been on one or two, and when it starts to sway in the wind, that's when you really start to grab hold. I found this picture last night, and I'm like, I started to get vertigo just looking at the picture. And then I'm thinking, the guy taking the picture, what is he holding on to? Because he's obviously got a camera. But you have to have structural integrity to be useful, right? People in Florida are finding out how much structural integrity do their buildings have, right? And this is kind of where I land with this thought is, do you want God to find your life useful? Because I find myself praying that a lot. God, use me. And I think he wants to, but then the question becomes, is there enough integrity in your life that God can walk through it and actually use it? Do you have enough structural integrity? Are you a whole enough person in all circumstances, on all occasions, that God can utilize your life? Will we live as people of integrity or not? Now, Abraham chose to. At least at this point, he proclaims that that is what he wants to do when he talks with Abimelech. And immediately, it opens opportunities for him, right? Because after Abraham swears that he will maintain some relational integrity, yes, I will do it, he has an opportunity to enter into a conversation that had yet not happened. Something changed when Abraham entered into a relationship that had integrity. Because Abraham confronts Abimelech about a well that had been dug by Abraham's people and then taken by force by Abimelech's people. Now, you might look at this and wonder, what is the big deal about a hole in the ground? But don't forget that in this day and in this age, a well was hugely important. Because wells were not just holes in the ground, they were the way you sustained life. If you did not have access to a well, your family and your herds and your flocks would not prosper, certainly, and might actually perish. So this is not just a hole in the ground that they're fighting over. It's something much bigger than that. It's interesting, though, to note that Abraham says this well that we dug, that my people dug, was taken by force, and yet, as far as we know, Abraham did not choose to respond with force himself. I believe he could have. I believe if he was strong enough to get some kings together and rescue Lot, then he had enough force at his disposal to strike back with force when something was taken from him by force, but he chose not to do that. Abimelech seems surprised. I had no idea this happened. I don't know who is responsible. He seems to be saying implicitly, you have been wronged. Something has gone wrong here, and I don't know who, and I don't know how. But we can see already that Abraham, because he's beginning and ideally maintaining a relationship with integrity, he gets these relational and conversational opportunities with these curious onlookers. And I truly believe, if we live lives of integrity, of wholeness, even when it's inconvenient, that we will have opportunities for the same types of conversations, that God will open those doorways, that we can say things or ask things that we otherwise couldn't because we're walking in a relationship that has integrity. Will we be people of integrity or not? Abraham responds, but it's a response we may not expect. Because even though Abraham suffered a forceful wrong, he responds to Abimelech's presence and his desire for partnership with grace and generosity. Right? Because we read what happened. And he said, listen, Abimelech, we dug this well, my people, we dug this well, and pretty soon your people, your servants came along, and by force they took this well from us. And Abimelech kind of basically says, wow, I had no idea, you're right, something has gone wrong. And what does Abraham do immediately after that? Here's a bunch of animals, right? Can we all agree that Abraham would make a horrendous attorney? Right? He'd be a terrible lawyer. Because when you get to the place where everybody admits that you have been wrong, that's the time when you claim that you need to be repaid. That you're the one who deserves to get something because you have been wronged by another person. But when we get to the place where it's recognized that Abraham has indeed been wronged, he is the one who brings the cattle, the sheep, the oxen. And then beyond that group, there's another seven over here. Now, the cattle, sheep, and the oxen, do you know what this is? Think back to Abraham's interactions with God. These are the animals needed for a covenant sacrifice. These are the animals that will be cut in two. They will walk between the pieces together, making this promise to one another. So Abraham, after being forcefully wronged, is the person who brings what's needed for the covenant relationship. And then Abimelech says, what about these extra seven over here? And Abraham says, I want to give these to you as a gift so that we can agree that this dispute with the well is settled. Not what we might expect. It's Abraham who deserves to receive, to get, and yet he's the one who ends up giving. Abraham does not choose to return force with force. We already talked about that. Abraham does not demand retribution against those people who took the well. I believe he could have said, Abimelech, I'll point the guys out to you. I know who it was, and they need to be punished. No such thing happens. And no demand either for restitution. He doesn't say, I need something because of my loss, which it's entirely possible that Abraham suffered the loss of livestock because the well wasn't accessible. And yet he brings the livestock to the table. And it's all because he's most interested in peacemaking. It's the relationship with Abimelech that matters most to him. And this is just a very early foreshadowing of a beautiful sermon that Jesus preached called the Sermon on the Mount. And at the very beginning of that Sermon on the Mount, we call it the Beatitudes. In the midst of those Beatitudes, Jesus said, blessed are the peacemakers, for they will be called what? Children of God. Kind of funny, as I was studying, thinking, Father Abraham was a child because he was a child of God. He displays what Jesus later boldly preaches and proclaims, that those who want to call themselves children of God should be peacemakers in the world. So that leaves us with the final question then. What does it mean? What does it look like to be people who build peace? To be the peacemakers that we have been called by Jesus to be? I find it interesting that in the language of this story, Abraham and Abimelech went from making, we're told, a treaty to making an oath, and then finally to making a covenant. And there is some language difference in the original Hebrew that lends itself toward this, but I really love what was done in the English translation, going from treaty to oath to covenant as the relationship progressed. Because there are some differences there, right? Because you can have a treaty with someone and still live very, very far apart and hold all the animosity that you want. All a treaty is a ceasefire. A treaty just says, I'm going to stop shooting at you and you're going to stop shooting at me. We can still live way far apart. We can ignore each other. We can even still hate one another from a safe distance. We're just going to stop shooting. Which is better than shooting one another, but it's not much better. What about an oath? An oath is getting to a place where you can be what I would call functionally honest with someone. You may still not like them, you may just tolerate them, but you're in close enough proximity and you say, listen, I will be functionally honest with you. If you ask me something, I'll tell you the truth. Which is better than a treaty. But I love it that the story concludes saying that they made a covenant. Man, a covenant is so much different. A covenant is when you say, I will bring my whole self, no fractions out there, no fractions over here. I'll bring my whole self into this relationship, and I will put you ahead of me. It's why we call it a marriage covenant. It's when we say to another person, I will put you ahead of me with all that I am. It's why we call it a membership covenant when you join a church, because you're saying, with all that I am, I will put the body ahead of myself. So I love it that they move from treaty to oath to covenant. And when they reached that covenant of peace, Abraham did two things at the very end of the story. He planted a tree and he worshiped God, is what we're told. At the very end, he planted a tree and he worshiped God. I got to thinking, why a tree? Why plant a tree? And if you read this story in context of the other stories, you realize this tree serves pretty much the same purpose as the altars that Abraham built before. Abraham has built an altar at places where either God has revealed himself or places he wanted to remember something important had happened. But this time he builds a tree. And I don't know for sure why, but I would like to think it's because when you build a tree, you believe you're going to be somewhere for a while. You don't plant a tree if you expect to move along shortly after. And if you read the rest of the story, you found out that Abraham indeed stayed in that area for a long time. He made peace, he planted a tree, and then he worshiped. Because making peace is a reason for worship and for remembrance. This peace wouldn't have been possible without the God who has been with Abraham and also had been speaking to Abimelech. It's really God who has created and brokered the peace, and he just finally found two willing participants at this time. But anytime there is peace, it's an opportunity to worship the God who brings peace and to celebrate that. I mean, you know this as well as I do just from life. When you experience peaceful reconciliation with someone, you want to sing about it. You want to shout about it. Even when you see it between other people, it just brings your heart this wellspring inside of you. Peacemaking is an opportunity and a reason for worship and remembrance. And of course, we believe that this begins with God. Because God has made peace with all of mankind on a tree, but not a tamarisk tree, on a Calvary-shaped tree. Colossians chapter 1. For God was pleased to have all his fullness dwell in him, that is Christ, and through him to reconcile to himself all things, whether things on earth or things in heaven, by making peace through his blood shed upon the cross. I tell you what, Colossians chapter 1, I could probably preach 24 sermons just on Colossians 1. It is one of the most beautiful chunks of scripture. And this part is just so phenomenal. We are so rebellious toward God, so violent towards one another. And it's God who proactively reaches out and says, I will make peace. I don't expect you to reconcile yourselves to me. I will be the one to step in. I'm reconciling all things to myself, and I'm doing it through the blood of my son on a tree. But the story doesn't end there, because we receive peace with God through Christ, but then we are called to be people of integrity who can build relationships of peace. People of integrity can build relationships of peace. Listen to it explained this way in Romans chapter 12. Do not repay anyone evil for evil, but be careful to do what is right in the eyes of everyone. Integrity. If possible, as far as it depends on you, live at peace with everyone. Do you notice the words there? Words like anyone, everyone. Those are really inclusive. It doesn't invite you to start making a list of all the people to whom that does not apply in your life. Everyone and anyone are very, very big words. Live with integrity and wholeness in the eyes of everyone. And as far as it depends on you, live at peace. Now, sometimes you'll do everything that you can, right? Sometimes people will simply refuse to live at peace with you. You'll do everything you can possibly think of. And do you know what we learn about further on in Romans chapter 12? When that happens, when you have done everything possible to be a person who lives with integrity, seeking to make relationships based on peace, and there are still people who refuse to be at peace with you, we're told this: do not take revenge. If your enemy is hungry, feed him. If he's thirsty, give him something to drink. If you think you can end the problem by closing your door on your enemy, you're wrong. Jesus Christ has called us to be peacemaking people. And when we do so, when we have lives of integrity in the midst of curious onlookers and we seek to build relationships of peace, I truly believe that is when we lift Jesus Christ on high and he can draw all men and women to himself so that they might know him, love him, and serve him. So three things to think about as we finish our time together. Here's the first one. Are you living your life with integrity? How strong is the structure of your life's integrity? Are you a Fort Knox? Are you a wobbly rope bridge? Are you somewhere in between on the spectrum? What does your life integrity look like? How honest are you, even when it is not convenient for you? Secondly, ask God today, during the time that we have to silently reflect, ask God to give you open opportunities and conversations with curious onlookers who see his presence and provision in your life. Because there are still curious onlookers as we walk through this world as foreigners and strangers. It's my prayer that God, people will see God's presence and provision in our lives and will open us up for conversations. And lastly, consider someone with whom you are currently at odds. And that phrase, at odds, could be anything on a huge spectrum. You figure that out. But consider someone with whom you're currently at odds, and from your perspective, have you exhausted all the possible ways to seek peace? Is it a relationship that's in the midst of craziness? Just try and get to a treaty or get to an oath, functional honesty, but ideally get to a place of covenant. So take a moment or two if you want to close your eyes and pray, if you just want to read through those words, and I'm confident the Spirit can continue to speak to your heart when I stop talking, and then I'm going to close this with prayer in just a moment or two.